So welcome to week six of the series Make Your Bed. Just before we start, a couple of announcements. First of all, just to remind everyone again, a week from tomorrow night we have the Mindful Minyan and the meal. If you can't come to the meal, please still come join us for the Minyan. Also want to just point out that next week we're still having a lesson on that's next week. The next week will be the last one. Then we're going to break for Pesach. And I want to just mention in terms of next term, normally we kind of run similar to the school terms, but this term, the school terms are a big balagan, so every school is starting at a different time because there's different, the Pesach didn't coincide with the school term this year. So I'm just going to ignore the school holidays, if that's okay. And we're going to start the Thursday after Pesach, which is the 12th of April. So the 12th of April will be the new one. I hope that works for everyone. I'll announce the topic hopefully next week. But the 12th of April, which is the Thursday after the whole Pesach, will begin again. So next week is the last one. And then we'll start with the new one on 12th of April. Just also one other announcement. It's coming up to Pesach and... coming up to Pesach, and of course on Pesach night by the Seder, there's a big mitzvah to eat a good size of shmura, hand-baked shmura matzah. So if anyone doesn't have and would like to have shmura matzah for the Seder, please let me know and I can arrange it. That's for Pesach. Okay, so we're working through the various lessons of... Yeah, we're good? Okay, so we're working through the various lessons of the book by McRaven, the lessons he learned from SEAL training in the Navy. Just to review a little bit from last week. Last week we covered two chapters, two important lessons but sort of connected. The first one was, if you want to change the world, get over being a sugar cookie. You know, that was the punishment that he had, and just move on. In other words, we talked about not blaming, not becoming a victim, but to get work through challenges and move on, looking to the future, which was connected to the second lesson we talked about last week, which is the concept of failure, that failure is a tool of growth. If we look at it properly, when we're talking about blaming, we talked about the four excuses that people use based on the formula which we developed. Got to do with the four laws of damages which the Torah gives us, and we divided into four parts. There was the concept of the animal, which is the excuse people give that I have, that's my animal, that's why God made me, I can't help it. The next one was the fire, the damage of fire, the concept of I lost control, I couldn't help it. Or the man, which means I'm special, or the pit, which means I'm worthless, and therefore I just can't move and I can't change. And all those things are not true, of course, because a person can work through all them. They do have an effect, but we need to work through the challenge and move on. We talked about the whole concept of failure and the idea that normally there's two responses to failure. One is the one of arrogance, in other words, denying that I made a mistake. The other one is a response of despair and paralysis. Either of which are no good because they don't help any, they just set us back. Whereas if we view failure different as being a catalyst for growth, we can actually learn from the failure and be improved, like he explained in that particular chapter. And at the end of last week I just showed you a thing where sometimes something which looks very negative can be transformed into something positive using the Hebrew words nega and oneg, which are the same letters. Nega meaning a plague, oneg meaning pleasure. Same letters, but they need to be turned around. When they're turned around, it can be used as a catalyst for amazing growth. Okay, today we're going to go through the lessons that we learned from chapter 6 in the book. And this chapter is entitled the following. It says, if you want to change the world, slide down the obstacle course, the obstacle head first. Now, the background to this is that he talks about the training that they did in the Navy training, where they had to navigate an obstacle course, and they had to do it in a certain amount of time. And the idea was not to just jump over the obstacles and get through them, but the idea was to actually do it in record time. So he talks about a particular obstacle course that they were going through, and then there's this long rope that was very difficult to drop, and it was very scary, and there was two ways to do it. He was doing it very quickly, the whole obstacle course, but then when it came to that rope, he was sliding down very, very carefully, step by step, and he was losing time. So he says he could see that they were announcing the time. And he says the following, and I'm going to read, as I always do, I'm going to read some excerpts from the book, from the chapter. He says this one's a bit small because it's a long paragraph. I'll just read it out. He says, as I reached the end, I released my grip on the line, dropped into the soft sand, and ran to the next obstacle. The other students in my class were yelling encouragement back, but I could hear the SEAL instructor calling out the minutes. I had lost a lot of time on the slide for life, as they called it. My possum-style technique of negotiating the long rope was just too slow, but somehow I couldn't bring myself to slide down the rope headfirst. Going headfirst off the tower using a method that they called commando style was much faster, but also much riskier. You were less stable on the top of the rope than hanging underneath, and if you fell and injured yourself, you'd be washed out of the class. Continues to say, he says, I crossed the finishing line with a disappointing time. As I was doubled over trying to catch my breath, a grizzled old Vietnam vet with highly polished boots and a heavily stretched, starched green uniform stood hunched over me. When are you going to learn, Mr. Mack? He said with an unmistakable tone of contempt, that obstacle course is going to beat you every time unless you start taking some risks. Then he continues on, one week later, I pushed my fears aside, mounted the top of the rope, and thrust my body headfirst down the slide for life. As I crossed the finishing line, in a personal best, I could see the old Vietnam SEAL nodding his approval. It was a simple lesson in overcoming your anxieties and trusting your abilities to get the job done. The lesson would serve me well in the years to come. Then he spends a large part of the chapter talking about the times he spent in Iraq, with Saddam Hussein. He was part of the whole capture and the whole thing. And then he ends off he says he always remembers the motto. One of the commanders gave him a motto that who dares wins, right? And so on. And he ends off the chapter in the following. He says, life is a struggle and the potential for failure is ever present. But those who live in fear of failure, which is connected to last week, or hardship or embarrassment, will never achieve their potential. Without pushing your limits, without occasionally sliding down the rope headfirst, without daring greatly, you will never know what is truly possible in your life. Simple but powerful lesson. The lesson, of course, is the necessity and the need to take risks if we want to embark in a journey of growth. So I think I want to share with you this interesting observation that, to develop this a little bit, that we know that one of the greatest steps of growth that human beings take is when they're small children. Right? If you observe how quickly and how advanced a child gets from when they're born till they're about 4 or 5, it's incredibly amazing. And all the progress we make in life, generally speaking, pales into insignificance. We take baby steps when we grow up, if you know what I mean. Right? In other words, it's incredible. I mean, they learn to roll over, they learn to sit, they learn to walk, they learn to talk. Right? The steps, the jumps, the leaps that children take when they're very, very young is absolutely incredible. And the reason for that is that children are uninhibited and children take risks. Watch a child when they learn to walk, they get up, they fall. They get up, they fall umpteen times, and they keep going. Watch a child learn to roll over for the first time. They just keep on trying. It doesn't work, it does work. They try one way, they try another way. Learning to crawl. Some children end up learning a different strategy of crawling. You have these odd kids who have the very unique style of crawling, right? Why? Because it didn't work. The one way didn't work, so they tried a different way until they worked out putting their foot in a certain position and they crawl in their own very, very interesting, beautiful way, right? But it's just absolutely incredible. And the question we always have to ask ourselves is, what happens later? Why do we stop doing that, right? We don't grow in such great leaps when we get older, sometimes. And the question is why? And one of the answers is because we get scared of taking risks. Children are uninhibited, so they're not scared of failure. They're certainly not scared of embarrassment, because when children are 3 or 4 years old, there is no world around them. The only world that exists is their own. So therefore, there's nothing to be embarrassed of. They don't have that insecurity that we have as adults. And therefore, they take amazing risks. They're not scared of people laughing at them. They think it's laughing with them, and everyone is laughing with them, and everyone thinks it's cute, so it's fantastic. And they take these incredible risks. Later on, we develop a sort of failure, a fear, I should say, of taking risks. And when we develop that fear of taking risks, that fear starts to inhibit our growth and starts to stand in the way of all layers of character development and personal growth. Because to really grow, we have to take a risk. What does that mean? So let's just develop this, and apologies for those who might have heard my WhatsApp message yesterday, but I'm just going to repeat that because it's a very, very powerful lesson, and I'll develop it a bit. The upcoming festival of Pesach, of course, is the time of growth. That's what Pesach is. Pesach symbolizes the whole idea of us going out of our personal Egypt, right? We're all in our own Egypt, we're in our own prison that inhibits our growth. Yitziat Mitzrayim, going out of Egypt, means to go beyond our comfort zone, to actually grow, to take the next step, to jump onto the next part of the journey. But we also know that Pesach, the word Pesach, which in English we translate as Passover, Pesach actually means to jump. The commentaries connect the whole idea of Pesach with God leaping, so to speak, to take us out and asking us to leap. There's a pasuk, there's a verse in Tanakh where we talk about the God coming to redeem the Jewish people, jumping over the mountains and skipping over the hills, right? So there's this whole notion on Pesach of jumping as opposed to walking or running even. And the concept of that is that when we walk or we run, we make progress. But walking or running, even running, means that whenever you put a foot forward, your other foot is still back where you started from. You never completely detach, right? So therefore, the type of growth that, it's good growth, the type of growth that walking and running represents is an incremental growth. In other words, it's a type of growth which we sometimes need to do, where we grow within the context of who we are. That's also good growth, right? I mean, that's progress. In Jewish literature, we talk about people being called mehalchim, walkers, as opposed to angels, which are called omdim, stationary beings, because angels don't grow at all. They are who they are. They're holy, they're perfect, but they stay the way they are. People make progress. We change, but there's different types of change. And when we walk or we run in terms of changing, that's great, but it's not the ultimate growth. It's good for some of the time where we keep growing, we develop a context, we develop a reality, a paradigm, and then we grow within that. And that's okay. But it's not okay always. Pesach teaches us that once in a while we have to jump. And jump means we've got to take both feet off the ground, completely detached from where we were. Right? Completely. A complete jump. Because real growth means, and that's risky, that kind of growth is very risky. Or we feel that it's a big risk. We're scared. When we walk and we have one foot still back there, we still feel a sense of security. We feel we're not changing completely. Nothing terribly can go wrong. I can just improve a little bit, but I'm not taking the risk of completely shifting my mindset or shifting my practice or shifting my approach, my perspective, and therefore I'm still anchored. I'm still anchored in the reality of security that I've had till now. That's nice, but it's not real growth. Real growth means not to worry about risks, not to worry about failure, but to actually once in a while take a real jump, a leap, a quantum leap, where we take both feet off the ground, detaching ourselves from everything that we were and embracing something which we feel is completely new. That's real growth, and that's a growth that needs risk-taking. And that risk-taking is what brings real growth. This concept was actually developed before the Jews left Egypt. We know that the one who took us out of Egypt was Moshe Rabbeinu, Moses. We've mentioned this idea before, and he took us out of Egypt and he led us out into Exodus. But the message of real growth and the real redemption and real self-releasing from prison was given to Moshe Rabbeinu way before. When was it given? When he was told to be the lead of the Jewish people, which took place at the burning bush. Right? The famous story where Moshe Rabbeinu, Moses, was shepherding the sheep of his father-in-law. And suddenly he sees this crazy, amazing sight of a tree that is burning and not burning. There's a fire, but the branches aren't become consumed. And he realizes something very special, something very different, something that's obviously going to be a life-changing experience for him, which it was. And he says there, if you look carefully into the verse, when Moshe Rabbeinu sees this bush, he says he wants to go close to it. He wants to go and see what's happening. And he uses the expression, Asurana, let me go away and have a look what this bush is doing. And Rashi, the commentator Rashi, obviously is bothered by the expression, let me go away. He wasn't going away, he was going to. So why do we say going away? So Rashi says four words which are fundamental, an incredible foundation in real growth. Rashi says that Moshe Rabbeinu was saying to himself, Asura mikan lihitkarev l'sham. Let me go away from here so that I can come close to there. Now obviously, whenever if I walk from point A to B, obviously I'm going to go away from point A to go to B. So Moshe Rabbeinu wasn't saying that. That was just a long-winded way of saying, let me go see what's happening at the bush. But what he was really saying is, no, I see something completely different. I see a life-changing experience. I see a life-changing opportunity. I see that something is going to radically change. But I also know that for me to embrace that, I've got to go away from here first. I've got to detach. I've got to create a vacuum almost. And I've got to create a space where I'm completely divorced and detached from where I was. I've let go so that I can come close to that whole new experience. And that will be real growth. Which, of course, that whole concept of letting go is the theme of matzah that we eat on Seder night. I'm bringing in some Pesach concepts because we use the opportunity a little bit to get ready for Pesach as well. So that's the idea of Pesach. Pesach is when we eat matzah. What is matzah? Matzah is the loss of self. Now, loss of self is not a permanent state of being because we don't eat matzah all year round, unless you're crazy enough to like it, of course. But you don't have to eat matzah all year round, put it that way, right? But we eat matzah on Pesach because Pesach represents, symbolizes the beginning of the journey of growth, of real growth. And the beginning of the journey of growth is you can bring yourself back into the equation, but you have to have a stage where you just let go completely. You let go so that you can embrace something completely new. And when you embrace something completely new, you can reintroduce yourself to that new reality, to that new paradigm, to that new mindset. But first, the foundation has to be the matzah. Matzah is letting go. But letting go is hard, because letting go, there's a lot of real risks and perceived risks in letting go, because it makes us vulnerable. But that vulnerability is good. It's a space that creates creativity. It's a space that creates real growth. It's very similar to a concept which you mentioned many, many times, that when you plant a tree, for a seed to turn into a tree, the seed has to disintegrate, as we know. It actually decomposes in the ground before it comes into a tree. Because there's a concept taught in Kabbalistic writings that when you have yesh miyesh, when you have something that becomes something completely different, you have to have nothingness in between. Why do you have nothingness in between? Because that nothingness means that you're completely detached from the previous reality so that you can grow into a new reality. There was in 1977, the Lubavitcher Rebbe on Simchat Torah, on Shmini Atzeret, suffered a famous story, suffered a heart attack. And it was a very long story, very fascinating recovery. And one of the things in his very typical style, everything that happened to him that was new, he would always try to learn a lesson. So one of the processes, of course, is that they would take blood. The Rebbe didn't go to a hospital. They set up a hospital room unit in his room, in his office, and that's where he remained. But he had a lot of doctors and a whole team and so on. So one of the things they would do is they would take blood for blood tests. So he once asked the doctor to explain to him, how does a blood test work? In other words, how do you draw the blood? So he explained to him the simple thing, and he said, you put in a syringe and you create a vacuum, and that vacuum has no air. It's complete vacuum, and that vacuum draws blood. So the Rebbe said, that's an interesting thing, because that's a lesson of life. Because he said that just recently someone had written to him that he feels totally uninspired. He's like completely flat. So the Rebbe, in his very typical positive perspective, wrote back to this fellow and said, that's great. Because if you feel really good about yourself, then you're probably not going to grow. But now you can use this vacuum as a total opportunity to draw new life, blood being a symbol of life. If you feel that you're going through a period of nothingness, use it out. Use that period of nothingness to enter, to draw a completely new opportunity and a new lease on life and a new energy of life, so to speak. Same idea, because to go to a whole new level of growth, there has to be sort of a vacuum in between where there's nothing left from the previous concept. There's a story in the Talmud where someone made Aliyah, and in times of the Talmud there was a great sage, and he left Babylon and he went to the land of Israel. And in Babylon, they had a certain specific system of learning. And in Israel, there was a different system of learning, a superior system of learning, which is why today we have actually two Talmuds, the Babylonian Talmud and the Jerusalem Talmud, all based on the same principles of Torah, of Jewish learning, but it was a different form of learning, a superior form of learning in Israel. So this sage's name was Rabbi Zeira, and the Talmud tells us that Rabbi Zeira fasted to forget. He fasted multiple times to almost forget the system of learning in Babylon. Why? Because when he came to Israel, he wanted to embrace the superior system of learning, but not be interfered with the previous system of learning. He wanted to be completely fresh and open to a completely new system. So he wanted to almost forget his study, his learning, not forget the knowledge, but forget the mindset, the skill set, so to speak, of Babylon, so he should be ready to embrace a whole new skill set. Same idea. Now, that vacuum and that nothingness in between is dangerous, because sometimes things can get in the way. No one wants to be in a state of in between. When the seed decomposes in the ground, there's a risk it won't turn into a tree. When you detach from something, there's a risk that the new thing that you want to embrace might be too difficult, right? And it's quite a vulnerable stage, and it's a risk-taking experience. But nevertheless, it's a risk-taking experience that's completely critical for the concept of growth. I think I once shared with you this idea, again coming back to Pesach, that on Seder night we have this mitzvah of drinking 4 cups of wine, right? And 4 cups of wine, of course, correspond to 4 expressions of redemption, where that Torah says, I will take you out, I will save you, I will redeem you, and I will take you as a nation. So because of those 4 expressions of redemption that God uses when he redeems the Jewish people, we drink 4 cups of wine. Now, there's a very interesting halakha about what happens if, in addition to the 4 cups of wine, someone's crazy enough to drink more wine on Pesach night, or he wants to drink more wine, right? So are you allowed to? Are you allowed to, between the cups, have like a bit of a bonus l'chaim, you know, kind of thing, right? So the law is like this, that between the first and the second, you're allowed to, although the custom is not to. Between the second and the third, which is during the meal, you really can if you want to. However, between the third and fourth, you're not allowed to. The third must go directly into the fourth. You cannot break with something else. Why not? So one of the ideas behind it is this. If you look at the first 3 expressions of redemption, they're different to the fourth one. The first 3 expressions of redemption, God says, I will take you out of Egypt. I will save you, I will redeem you. In other words, it's all about what I'm going to take you away from. The fourth expression is what you're going to become, right? Now, that process was critical in the light of what we just discussed. They could never become God's nation, they could never become a free people unless they divorced slavery. Right? They have to get away from slavery, go away from Egypt, leave Egypt behind them. Whatever Egypt symbolized, whatever Egypt represented, they have to completely detach and say goodbye to the whole concept and mentality of being in Egypt. Only then they can graduate into a whole new reality, which is becoming the nation of God. However, God says, that's a dangerous spot. Once you've detached from Egypt, and you need to detach properly, in other words, when you've gone away from Egypt completely, what you've done is, you've created a nothingness, which is great, because it's a vacuum which now gives you an opportunity for a whole new process, a whole new journey, which is to become, I will take you as a nation, to become God's nation. However, you cannot interrupt that process, right? Because that's a risky few moments. So therefore, from the third cup, which is the end of turning away from Egypt, the third cup, which is the end of the process of saying goodbye to Egypt completely, detaching from Egypt completely, you must immediately then embrace the new reality. Don't leave the vacuum there for too long, because if you leave it there for too long, something else could interfere. Why? Because God recognizes that the process of real growth is jumping. The process of real growth is to completely detach from the previous reality, but God recognizes the risk involved in that. Because when you got 1 foot back in the old reality, so then it's safer. You've still got a reality to hold on to. So you know where you are, you know what you're doing, you know where you're going, but it doesn't bring real growth. But when you completely detach from the previous reality, like a real risk take, we understand that it's open to failure, and it's open to interference, and it's open to distraction, and therefore it's open to a process where you might not get to the new reality. And therefore God says, from the third cup, go right away into the fourth cup, because don't leave that vacuum there for too long, because otherwise the growth is too risky. Now, of course, as we said last week, if we do fail, it's okay too, because failure is a process of growth. Failure is a learning curve, if you look at it properly. And of course, that jumping that we're talking about, and that complete quantum leap of growth that we're talking about, obviously for each person it's different. As we said many, many times, that in the Shema, we are taught to love God with our heart, with our soul, u'b'chol me'odecha, which is a hard word to translate, but one of the translations is, in Hebrew, the word me'od means very. When you conjugate it to me'odecha, means your very, right? So that's the concept of growth. When we come to Pesach, or we come to the whole journey of growth, We need to learn to take risks, and the risk for each person is different. Because that quantum leap, that idea of jumping and leaving behind the previous paradigm, for every person that means something different. But what it has to, what the Torah says is, it has to, at least it has to be ma'od. It has to be a very big jump. Your very big jump, but a big jump nonetheless. I read a fascinating article from a psychologist called Carol Dweck, who wrote a book called Mindset, and she talks about the concept of the power of yet. Why does she call it that? Because she was involved in education, and she talks about creating a mindset growth. Sorry, a mindset of growth, I should say. Right? And she says that she heard about a high school in Chicago where students had to pass a certain number of courses to graduate, right? And if they didn't pass a course, they got a grade. What was the grade called? So it wasn't called fail. It never gave anyone a fail. What they did was, they gave them a not yet. That was the grade, not yet. Right? And hence the whole theory of not yet, right? Why? Because when students got a grade of not yet, they understood that they, not that they can't get there, they just didn't get there yet. Not yet, right? And she said that it was a turning point, because she launched into a whole research of children who have a growth mindset, no, they don't have a growth mindset. And her principal concept was this, that we all have amazing abilities, we all have amazing potential. We just have to believe in them. In other words, we all can grow. True, we all cannot grow the same way, that's true. We shouldn't delude ourselves. We all have strengths, we all have weaknesses, we all have skill sets that other people don't have, and things that other people have that we don't have. That's also true, but within our own context, we have much more infinite potential than we think we have. It's just a matter of having that desire to grow. It's a matter of having that desire to grow, not just incrementally, but to be brave enough to take a whole mindset shift, a whole paradigm shift, a whole risk-taking process, where we're ready to take a jump into the uncharted waters, into new realities, into new things of growth, new areas of growth. But if we are ready to do that, the scope and the opportunities of growth are amazing. And she talks about children who had the growth mindset, knows it didn't. She said there that they would give them challenges, and some kids would say, I love a challenge, or, you know, I was hoping that would be informative, or they understood that their abilities could be developed. That's a growth mindset. She says, but other students felt it was tragic, catastrophic, from their more fixed mindset. So she talks about a growth mindset and a fixed mindset. By default, many people have a fixed mindset, meaning they grow little bits and pieces, but not real growth. But people who have a growth mindset really can grow tremendously. And she said, from the ones who couldn't, from their more fixed mindset perspective, their intelligence had been up for judgment, and they failed. She says, instead of luxuriating in the power of yet, they were gripped in the tyranny of now. That's a very nice, nice way of putting it. And then she ends off the article, so I'll just read it to you. It's very beautiful. She says, I received a letter recently, because she did a lot of scientific study in what brings success and what brings development of ability. And it has less to do with how much ability you actually have, and more to do with the willingness to grow and take those risks and try new things and not be scared and afraid of failure. And she said, I received a letter recently from a 13-year-old boy. He said, Dear Professor Dweck, I appreciate that your writing is based on solid scientific research. 13-year-old kid. And that's why I've decided to put it into practice. I put more effort into my schoolwork, in my relationship with my family, in my relationship with kids at school, and I experienced great improvement of all these areas. And I realize, says this 13-year-old kid, that I've wasted most of my life. He's lucky. He came to the realization at 13. Right? And she ends off the article by saying, it's actually a lecture, a talk actually, but it's a transcript. She says, let's not waste any more lives, because once we know that abilities are capable of such growth, it becomes the human right for children, all children, all people really, but she's talking about children, to live in the places that create that growth, to live in places filled with yet. Right? So I think that's really what it is. It's about understanding that we can grow, which is really the message of Pesach. The message of Pesach is that we can go out of our own Egypt. We just have to be brave enough to do it. It wasn't easy for the Jews. Even after they went out, when things went wrong, they complained and they wanted to go back, many of them. They wanted to go back even though they knew that going back was going back to oppression, going back to slavery. In Egypt, by the way, 4/5 of the Jewish nation didn't want to leave and didn't leave. It's a staggering number if you think about it, right? But the whole Pesach story and the whole Exodus from Egypt involves 1/5 of the Jewish nation at the time, because 4/5 didn't want to leave and they didn't leave. Why? They were oppressed. 210 years have been stuck in Egypt, 86 years of tremendous, very, very hard labor and oppression and persecution. But the reality, you know, is always more comfortable. Doesn't matter how bad it is. And that's so sad, because we all have our own Mitzrayim, we all have our own Egypt, and we all are scared to leave it. We'll take small steps outside and leave one foot back, but we're scared to leave it because we're scared to take a risk. We're scared to overcome an obstacle course. We're scared to dive head first because we don't know what's on the other side. We're scared we might fail. We're scared we might be embarrassed. We're scared we might make a mistake. We're scared it might not work. So God came to the Jewish people and gave Moshe Rabbeinu to us and said, no, you can. You could leave and you could become a whole new nation. You could become a whole new people, which is leaving the slavery mentality behind. And 4/5 of the people didn't want to do it, even after all the miracles, even after all the plagues, even after witnessing everything that they witnessed. To leave was just too difficult. And for us to leave, it's also difficult. But it's about developing that growth mindset. That mindset that we can grow. We can take a jump, we can take a leap, and we can take the risk. Number one, taking a risk will bring greater creativity and greater growth. Okay. When this, by the way, became the whole journey of the Jewish people that left Egypt. There's a story of when they came to the Red Sea. Right? And had to... Oh, sorry, that's not there. When they came to the Red Sea and they had to cross the Red Sea. So they were trapped. I'm saying the story because this sheds light on another detail of this concept of growth. See, because sometimes not only are we scared to do it, we actually talk ourselves into it that it's impossible. Right? In other words, what the fear of failure does, it helps us or causes us to rationalize a certain perspective to believe that it's actually impossible. Once we talk ourselves into that it's impossible, then we're stuck. Right? In other words, at the first stages, we think it's possible, we're just too scared to do it. And we're scared to do it, so what we do is we talk ourselves into, we see a reality, what seems, and we develop a sort of mindset where we think it's impossible. Once it's impossible, then there's nowhere to go. So the story the Talmud tells us is when the Jews came to the Red Sea, they left Egypt, and 7 days later, as we celebrate on the seventh day of Pesach, 7 days later they came to the sea. By that time, Pharaoh had realized that the Jewish people have left and it was a mistake and he's upset. So he decides to pursue them with a tremendous army. The Jews come to the Red Sea. There's nowhere to go. They look back and they see Egypt coming behind them. I've mentioned this before. They broke into four groups. There were different opinions of what to do. I think I told you this before. There were four groups, four opinions. Some say the miracle was there were only four opinions, not many more. Imagine if 3 million Jews, only four opinions. That's like truly miraculous. But nevertheless, they were split and divided about what to do. Some of them even, one of the ideas was to pray. And God says to Moshe Rabbeinu, everything's a mistake. I've given you an instruction. I've told you there's a destination. There's a journey. Keep moving. Daber el bnei Yisrael v'yisau. Talk to the Jewish people and tell them to travel. But it was ridiculous because there was nowhere to travel. It was impossible. The Egyptians were at the back, they were trapped on the sides, the ocean's in the front, there is nowhere to go. Until there's a person called Nachshon ben Aminadav. The Talmud tells Nachshon ben Aminadav was a descendant of Yehuda, a very strong leader, was a leader of the tribe of Judah. And he says to the Jewish people, God says to go, we go. Ah, it's impossible? No such thing as impossible. If we know we can go, if we are told to go, if there's a goal, it doesn't matter how difficult it is. We just need to do it. And he jumps into the ocean and he keeps going until the water reaches his neck. And at that point it splits. Because for whatever reason, God gives us a test sometimes. and makes it look like it's impossible. The purpose, it's called a nisayon, a test. And the purpose of that test is so we should become stronger. So sometimes he puts us into a test where it seems completely impossible. This goes back to the very first and ultimate test that was given, the last test that was given to Abraham, the famous test of the Akedah, the binding of Isaac, where he went and God allowed the Satan, it says, the negative angel, to put obstacles in front of Abraham to see if he would still persist. And one of those tests is that he created an imaginary river where Abraham's path was blocked. So he could have said, well, I got the perfect excuse. God told me to do something difficult, put the river there, I can't do it, going home, it's too difficult. Nowhere to go. And he doesn't, he jumps into the river and the same thing happens. He goes until his neck and he says, God, if you want me to do this, you got to help me. And the river disappears. So why does he do that? Why did God have to make it difficult for him? Because that was part of the test. Part of the test was to test his commitment, to test his resilience, to test his strength and to nurture his strength and to make his strength greater, which it became by overcoming those obstacles. Nachshon ben Aminadav says the same thing. It is impossible, he says, that we shouldn't be able to reach our destination if the opportunity is there. If God gave us that opportunity, if we know it's the right thing to do, we have to be able to achieve it. Ah, there's an ocean. Okay, so there's an ocean. So what? And he jumps in. And as he jumps in, until he can do whatever he can do, the ocean disappears. And the truth is that is the journey of life. Because we are told by the Kabbalists that the water of the Red Sea, the rushing waters of an ocean, represent the turbulence of life. Often we come to a Red Sea. Often we know we have to get someone, and suddenly the more we know we have to get there, the more we know how important it is, suddenly there's all these obstacles that stand in the way. Imaginary oceans, or real oceans maybe. And they're very, very turbulent. And we don't know what to do. We try to escape. Maybe we'll go back to our old ways. Maybe forget the whole new journey. Maybe we'll just escape into the area of prayer. Maybe we'll just give up. Maybe we'll despair. And God says, an ocean being there, when it seems like there's no opportunity, that's no reason to stop. That's just another obstacle to overcome. It's another risk to take. And the lesson of this story is that we have to be the Nachshon ben Aminadav. The Nachshon ben Aminadav means that we jump into the waters. We take the obstacles head on and we just keep moving. And we keep moving towards our goal because we know it's important. Obviously, when we say we keep moving, it doesn't mean a negative moving, where we keep moving and destroy people on the way, God forbid. We keep moving in ourselves. We keep becoming stronger and stronger. And eventually, as we become stronger, we get to the point where almost it seems it's impossible, but we're determined to keep moving, that's when the sea splits. And that's when we see the light. And that's when we see that we're able to go through and make it to the other end and reach our destination and reach our goal. We find this happen a little bit later, nationwide, just in terms of the story of Exodus. Eventually, God takes us to the desert. He gives us the Torah and then said, okay, we're now to the next part. What's the next part? And here you see again this concept of real growth and risk-taking. Moshe Rabbeinu sends 12 spies to the land of Israel to spy out the land so that we can go and conquer it and take the land of Israel. We know the famous story, of course, the 12 spies went, and 10 of them, they all come back, and 10 of them give a very, very negative report. Right? The story goes, they came back on the night of Tisha B'Av, they created hysteria, the Jews cried, didn't want to go, and God said, this is the night you cried for nothing, this will be a day of national mourning, and Tisha B'Av unfortunately became the day when the temples were destroyed, and so on and so forth. One of the things, I've shared this to you many, many times, one of the things they said when they came back, they said, we saw giants there, and we seemed to ourselves like as small as grasshoppers, and that's the way we seemed to them, right? The concept of very inferior, very insecure, we can't do it, it's too hard. So that's just a general thing, insecurity. However, the question is asked on the story is that when Moshe Rabbeinu sent the spies, he sent great people. They were tzaddikim, they were righteous people. They weren't anyone. They were leaders of the tribes, 12 of them. Two of them remained righteous, Yeshua and Caleb. But 10 of them messed up. So how did they mess up so fast? They were great people. And one of the great explanations that he's given that turns the whole story upside down is this. They never for one moment believed that the Jewish people cannot conquer the land of Israel. Obviously, they knew we can. They knew we can conquer the land of Israel because God had promised us the land. He took us out of Egypt and gave us the Torah in the desert, and then the ultimate destination was to be in the land of Israel. So that was a given. but they feared something completely different. They feared that the Jewish people would not be able to conquer their own spiritual struggles. Why? What happened was, and they were right, by the way, they had reason to fear. What happened was, when the Jews were in the desert, which continued on afterwards for 40 years, they were incredibly protected, not only physically, but spiritually. Don't forget, what happened in the desert? The desert, they didn't have to work. They had the manna that fell every day from heaven, spiritual bread, spiritual sustenance. They were protected by the clouds of glory, a miraculous protection. What did they do all day? They went to learn with Moshe Rabbeinu. They had a beautiful life. It was an unbelievable life, a life of spiritual bliss. The spies knew that when the Jews come into the land of Israel, everything changes. They will suddenly be thrust into a normal day-to-day life. They will be thrust in a life where you have to work hard for a living, where you've got distractions of all kinds of material and physical challenges that can very easily distract spiritual growth. And they were worried that that risk is too high. It's too high for the Jews to take. They were worried about their spiritual failure. And they had what to worry about, because when the Jews did go to Israel, they failed many times. And we failed up time and time again, up and down, throughout Jewish history. We're still around to tell the story. We're still doing well as a nation. We're still moving forward. But individually, we've had patches of great spiritual failure, up and down, all the time. So they knew what they were talking about. And yet they were severely punished. Why? Because God didn't want the Jewish people to remain in the desert. Because to remain spiritually protected means you remain like an angel. Beautiful, holy, perfect, but no growth. And God wanted people to become stronger. The purpose of creation is to become stronger. The purpose of creation is to bring holiness and purity even into lower levels, even into the physical, even into the material. It's a struggle. You've got to be able to marry together the world of the spiritual and the world of the physical. You've got to be able to marry together values and morality with real, tangible, physical, material living. Not easy. It's a big risk, but it's a risk that brings ultimate growth. God wanted them to take that risk. He says, I'm sending you into Israel to take a risk. I'm sending you into Israel to a battlefield, to a place where you're going to have to struggle to spiritually grow. You're going to have to struggle not to destroy the other person when he competes with you in business. You're going to have to struggle when you have to give something away which you've earned, worked hard for, but you have to help and support someone else. You're going to have to struggle not to get angry with other people. It's going to be much tougher in Israel. But it's going to be a completely different reality. But that's where you're going to experience growth. And the spies didn't get it. They were holy people. And because they were holy people, they didn't want to take that risk. And they wanted to preserve and spiritually protect the Jewish people. But they made a fatal mistake. Because it's only with the risk that you can grow. And it's only believing that you can grow that you will grow. And when they said, the telling sentence at the beginning of the story was, they said, we were like grasshoppers in the eyes of the giants, and so we seem to them. What they were really saying is, we see ourselves as grasshoppers. We see ourselves too small, too weak to be able to take that risk and to jump into that battlefield. And God said, that's your mistake. You need to believe that you can do it. We said this many times. Every day we wake up in the morning and we say Modeh Ani, right? And the last two words of Modeh Ani is Rabba Emunatecha, great is your faith. And I've shared with you the explanation many times, that what the commentaries say, what that means is, great is your faith in us. God wakes us up in the morning. Being asleep, by the way, is much safer. Right? I told you once, that the guy that got up in the morning and he said to a prayer, and he said, God, so far I've had a good day. I haven't made anyone angry. I haven't hurt anyone. I haven't done anything. I'm agreed, but I'm about to get out of bed, right? So sleeping is much safer. And yet God wakes us up in the morning and he gives us our soul back. And he says, face the day. And we're grateful and we express gratitude. And one of the things, but we express gratitude, by the way, with some reservation. Because we say, God, it was really nice of you to get me up. But I know it's going to be a tough day because there's going to be challenges along the way. I'm about to get up. I'm about to go to work. And there's a guy there in the work I don't like. And he gets on my nerves. And I don't want to get angry. Or my kids are going to fight before they go to school. And I might explode. Or I know that I should do something for my spiritual well-being, but it's going to be tough. Maybe I should just go back to sleep, right? So in other words, it's great when we get up in the morning and we have gratitude. We do. We thank God for being alive. But we have, consciously or subconsciously, some reservation, because we know it might be a tough day. We're not sure if we're going to succeed. And the way we do succeed, and there will be risks we have to take if we maximize the opportunity of the day. Meaning, it's possible to get up and remain asleep all day as well. You know what I'm saying? Like, there's a beautiful expression in the Shulchan Aruch, in the laws of Rosh Hashanah. There are some people who have a custom that on Rosh Hashanah, because it's special days and days of judgment, days where God, you know, determines what's going to happen the rest of the year, and so on and so forth. So there are people that have a custom that during the daytime of Rosh Hashanah they don't sleep, meaning they don't take the traditional Shabbos shluf as we would do on Shabbos afternoon, but on Rosh Hashanah they don't do that, right? So they stay up. When they finish eating, they go back to shul, or they say Tehillim, they pray, they learn, whatever the case is. A famous idea. But it says, there's a beautiful line in Shulchan Aruch, it says that those who want to keep that custom of not sleeping on the days of Rosh Hashanah should remember that Yoshev Batel Keyashen Dami, that when you sit and waste time, it's like sleeping. There's no difference. So, don't think you're a great holy person. I stayed up a whole day. I didn't go to sleep even though the food was really good and I was tired. But I sat and schmoozed and talked nonsense the rest of the day. And I wasted the day. Wasting the day is as good as sleeping, right? So when we wake up in the morning, we have a reservation. We know that it's going to be tough and we don't want to continue sleeping, and we don't want to sleep waking up either. We want to maximize the potential of the day. So we know there's a lot of risk taking to really grow throughout the day, but we also have to believe that it's possible. Why do we believe it is possible? Because we end off the Modei Ani thanks prayer by saying, Rabba Amunatecha, great is your faith in us. God wakes us up and he says to us, I believe in you. I believe you can do it. I'm going to send you into the battlefield, but I know you can do it because there's tremendous potential. I know you can do it even if there's turbulent waters, even if you think there's an ocean there, but if you take the jump and you take the risk, even if you make a mistake, I don't mind, as long as you take the risk and you try hard and you come back and you keep going, you can do it. So I want to just share with you a beautiful idea I just came across with. Okay, just came across the idea two days ago. Also a story of the Jewish people in the desert. You know, one of the things is they had the manna that fell from heaven, but they also had the water that came out of the rock. And then when Miriam died, it was there in the merit of Moshe Rabbeinu's sister, but when Miriam died, the water stopped. So God said to Moshe Rabbeinu, I want you to go and speak to the rock and take out water. That was a famous story that Moshe Rabbeinu, the water didn't come out, so he hit the rock, and then the water came out, he was punished, and God says, whatever. But the idea was that the water had to come from the rock. What's this idea? Like, I mean, if God can perform miracles, so why does he make it so difficult? I mean, if we're going to get the water anyway, so why the rock and the water and speak to the rock and hit the rock? What's this all about? So let me show you, you know, there's amazing things that happen with the Hebrew language, because I've shared this with you before. The Hebrew language is holy, and there's many, many secrets and unbelievable things that are in the Hebrew language. One of the things we have in the Hebrew language is that in every word you've got hidden ideas. And the hidden ideas come from how you spell out the letters, right? Every word, in other words, is what we call, so I'll give you an example. The letter Aleph, right? If there's a word that has the letter Aleph, so Aleph is the revealed letter, but then the hidden letters of Aleph is Lamed and Pei, because the way you spell out the letter Aleph is Aleph, Lamed, Pei, right? You with me? Yeah? Okay. So if you take the word for rock in Hebrew, God tells Moshe Rabbeinu, go and talk to the rock and extract water. Rock is Samach Lamed Ayin. But if you spell it out, listen to what happens. So you see there, Sela, he told him to go to the Sela of the rock. And now, spell out the word Sela, Samach Mem Chaf. You see that? Lamed Mem Dalet Ayin Yud Nun. So the middle letter of each of the hidden letters is Mem, two Mems and a Yud. What's two Mems and a Yud? Mayim. Water. In the rock, there's water. What does that mean? It means God says like this, I want you to go and go to a rock. A rock is something that looks like there's no potential for water. A rock is not the thing you would think of when you want to talk about water. But v'dibarte melasela. Empower the rock. Speak to the rock. Encourage the rock. Because we need to not only understand our own potential, we need to believe in each other's potential and encourage others to take risks and to grow. So God says, this is a metaphor for leadership. V'dibarte melasela. You lead people, you might think you hit a rock. You might think, that person, never going to make it. There's no water. There's no life. There's no potential in that person. But if you spell out the word Sela, God says, you will see, in the Sela, there's Mayim. Because Samach Mem Chaf, Lamed Mem Dalet, Ayin Yud Nun, which is the spelling out the word Selah with complete hidden letters, you will see in the middle lies water. There is water, even in the rock. Never think that there's an ocean there and therefore you can't get to your destination, and never think that you're talking to a rock and therefore there's no water there. Everyone has potential. We all have potential. We all can change. We all can grow. We all can succeed better than we do. We can all be a better person. We can all control our anger a little bit. We can all become kinder. We can all become more mindful. We can all spiritually grow. We can all do it all. Each one on our own way. Each one at our own pace. Each one on our own journey. But with real growth. Real growth that comes from believing in our potential, and real growth that comes from taking a risk. And therefore, that's a lesson we always have to remember, going back to the book. If you want to change the world, or ourselves for that matter, you've got to take the plunge and go head first. Don't worry about failure. You could do it, and we could do it with a good pace, and we could do it with real growth, with our feet off the ground, but we just have to be ready to believe that we can do it and take the risks that are involved. Have a great day and a great week. Don't forget, next week, we still have one more, and then we begin again on the 12th of April.